Hello, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, and I'm joined again by Alec Rich and Andrew Forsch. Alec, Andrew, good to have you back. The A-team, if you will, because everyone's name begins with the same letter. How are you both?
Yeah, very well. Thanks. Good to be back.
By popular demand.
Indeed so, or your editor's demand, which is kind of the same thing. So again, listeners, you will notice there's no Ian Wenick in this lineup, but don't worry. He is making an appearance. The idea of sitting out two in a row was simply too much for him. So we pre-recorded a special segment with Ian all about a massive deal that took place this week. So if you want that, skip ahead to around the sort of 15, 16 minute mark, if that's what you came for. But if you want a more sort of balanced diet in your podcast, stay with us. We've got some massive stories to talk about. And Alec, let's cut straight to the chase. You are fresh-ish off the plane from Georgia, where you went this week to report on the sort of the next leg of this big dispute, this big breakaway around this $129 billion team leaving Merrill and going independent. So last week, Andrew, you gave us the lowdown on that. And the big update really was they were headed to court. And so, Alec, you also headed to court. So, yeah, what happened?
That's right. Yeah, I caught the 6 a.m. flight down to Atlanta on Tuesday morning. This was, you know, this essentially hearing that, you know, Merrill was looking for a temporary restraining order to essentially stop OpenArc, Dynasty, and Schwab from soliciting the wirehouse's clients.
OpenArc being the name of the new entity that this team had set up. Yeah,
that's right. The $129 billion firm. And, you know, Merrill went into this looking for a judge to grant them this temporary restraining order and expedited discovery. And it's, you know, we were debating before it started how long we thought this might go. It ended up being 3 hours. And, you know, for those not privy to the courtroom dynamics, reporters in federal court, you know, I have this old-fashioned pen and paper, you know, scribbling as fast as I can of what was being said. And then
you had to hand in your phone and laptop at the gates, basically.
That's right. Yep. And, removed from the outside world and then trying to run down after the decision to, you know, call my editors and have the, you know, had the story partially pre-written and just being able to relay the results. But yeah, it was a super interesting hearing, and just from the extent of, you know, Merrill Lynch's lawyers were really trying to play up the fact that this, you know, unit within their firm that this breakaway, you know, was removed from, is now, you know, suffering a great deal, was their argument essentially, that it's been gutted with 120 plus exits. And, you know, in the time since, it's called the initials are GCIAS. And, you know, they were arguing it's been, you know, severely kind of hurt by this breakaway. And, you know, they really were asking for this TRO as a means of, you know, trying to also, you know, find further evidence of what they saw as, you know, soliciting efforts and violations of the broker protocol, you know, by OpenArc and the other two defendants. And yeah, so we can get into some of the further arguments and things from both sides, but that's kind of the general basis. And what happened was the judge denied that TRO and denied the motion for expedited discovery, essentially ruling that, you know, this is going to go to FINRA anyway through an arbitration hearing. And the judge was essentially more than happy to allow that to go forward in that capacity rather than, you know, ruling on it, you know, in court here.
Fantastic. Thank you. So I'm interested to know, I guess, two main follow-ups are supposed to be. What was the sort of rationale for that? And what are the ramifications of it? So maybe let's start with the first of those. You've touched on this a little bit already, but Merrill's grounds for this, I think you've covered. But what was the judge's grounds for saying, actually, look, that's not enough, or you haven't proved the point you're trying to make?
Right. I think it really came down to, you know, Merrill Lynch just did not have enough hard evidence showing, you know, efforts of, you know, pre and post solicitation by, you know, the defendants here, OpenArc, Dynasty, and Schwab. You know, the Merrill Lynch's team was essentially trying to argue that this was a collaborative effort by, you know, Dynasty and Schwab over time. They, you know, worked together in coordination with these various advisors at OpenArc, who are now at OpenArc, and were previous at Merrill Lynch, to kind of, you know, steal these trade secrets and, you know, go through with this corporate raid, as they called it. And what the judge ultimately ruled was that this information of belief, you know, as she called it, was just not enough to kind of grant that TRO to them. And there was a crucial point about an hour into Merrill's, you know, opening arguments, where the judge, you know, directly asked Merrill Lynch's, you know, lead counsel, what kind of hard evidence do you have, you know, against the defendants to kind of show that this pre and post solicitation, you know, took place outside of kind of the one affidavit from a defendant that, you know, from someone who was not a named defendant in the case. And there wasn't really a great answer to that from Merrill Lynch's team. And, you know, after that happened, the defense for OpenArc, you know, Dynasty and Schwab, all those lawyers kind of seized on that and really kind of hammered home throughout the rest of the hearing that, you know, there just, you know, was not enough hard evidence here that kind of proved these alleged violations of the broker protocol. And so maybe through a discovery process that would have come out, but obviously the judge denied that expedited discovery motion. And so that was pretty essential. There are, you know, also other kind of discussions about, you know, what constitutes a raid, you know, whether this was, you know, fully a business unit that was lifted out of Merrill Lynch, whether these were at-will employees who were, you know, free to do as they chose in this instance. And so that was kind of an interesting line of argument as well, that obviously the judge sided with, you know, Merrill Lynch on that front too.
And Andrew, you touched on this, I think, last week, or certainly in your reporting, if not on the podcast, that when you had spoken to lawyers in and around this case, that had been something that had come up as an issue that would be sort of relevant, would be around whether it constitutes a raid or not.
Yeah, exactly. There's a question of, you know, in order to be a raid, historically, the general wisdom is that you need somebody to do the raiding. In order for it to be a raid, there has to be a raider.
You can't raid yourself.
You can't raid yourself. Although, you know, this, one of the reasons that this was such a kind of important and far-reaching case is that maybe you could. Depending on what the judge and the courts decided, obviously it looks like it's gone the other way. But there's an element of this too that's important to note, that, like, obviously some of these points are going to be litigated in FINRA arbitration now rather than in the courts, which of course is a private forum as opposed to federal court, which is a public forum. And so it doesn't mean that all of, you know, this decision doesn't mean that all of these claims are just going away. It means that they'll be litigated in a different forum. But this is still important, you know, because it's not just about the outcome in litigation for Merrill Lynch. Part of the reason that they're doing all of this is to send a message to advisors. They have to push back and show that, you know, we're not going to let enormous teams like this just go without a fight. So part of it is about public image. And even though some of these claims are going to resurface in FINRA, they've still taken a very public loss. And it doesn't look good for Merrill to bring these claims, to not have evidence, and then to get this ruling, even if it isn't the end. It will embolden advisors in the move to independence. And it's just generally, like, not a great look in court for Merrill, even if it isn't the thing that they're kind of most worried about. Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. It brings me neatly onto that other sort of question, which is, yeah, ramifications. And but before I do, Alec, I you had a hand up, so swing in here.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to that point. You know, kind of a essential line of argument that the defense team took here was that there was nothing out of the ordinary about this situation outside of just the size of the team. And I think that that, you know, generally, you know, bodes well, you know, moving forward for a lot of, you know, firms looking to break away, as long as they kind of adhere to the general broker protocol, you know, restrictions in terms of what you can and can't take, you know, that size is irrelevant, because, you know, Merrill was obviously trying to argue the opposite.
Really interesting. Okay, so let's just quickly, to sort of round this off, talk about the ramifications then and sort of next steps. So this goes to FINRA, where you mentioned, again, a lot of these things could be litigated. So what could the upshots be there? We won't be able to fly down and listen in on those hearings. We may never know the final outcome. I suppose we might, in that we will see the ultimate size of OpenArc, and that could tell us at some point what they got or didn't get. Or is it more nuanced than that?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent, as you know, Merrill Lynch was kind of arguing, and the defense kind of agreed with to an extent, this breakaway is already done, and the judge also agreed with that. So to an extent, kind of showing the harm done, you know, maybe though, I mean, Andrew might know better than me, you know, maybe there would be, you know, some further kind of monetary penalties or something like that down the line, but, you know, it's obviously hard to say. Yeah, at this juncture, and you know, Judge Calvert, who was the judge in this case, was obviously not going to rule on that. You know, I caught up with OpenArc's lead attorney, you know, outside the courthouse after the decision, and you know, he essentially mentioned that you know, these underlying kind of claims from that end about, you know, preparing to compete is not competition, which they argued that kind of stuff will obviously be brought back up in front of FINRA. But I think at this point, you know, it's kind of hard to speculate about, you know, what necessarily FINRA may or may not rule on with regards to rating and stuff like that.
We also don't know, to be fair, whether Merrill has kind of laid out everything that it has. It may not want to reveal its entire hand publicly, you know. It's generally in everybody's best interest with this sort of thing, you know, unless there's egregious conduct to settle these, right? I mean, the advisors don't want to be, they're starting a new business. They don't want to be tied up in court, spending millions of dollars on attorney fees. You know, maybe clients are scared off from moving over because of this ongoing, you know, legal battle. We don't know if Merrill has kind of revealed its whole hand. Maybe it's sitting on some more evidence that it'll kind of bring to light in arbitration that it doesn't want out publicly. So we don't entirely know, you know, necessarily the whole picture.
Interesting. Well, I guess we'll try to find out a bit more. Obviously, arbitration is a bit more of a closed court, literally. That said, there's a lot of attention around this. There's a lot of people who might want some messaging in or out of the media around this. So I would say we'll keep our, you know, ears to the ground. And dear listener, we suggest you do the same, because this probably isn't the absolute last we've heard about this. But Alec, yeah, look, fantastic. Hope you enjoyed the trip down to Georgia. Certainly really valuable in terms of our reporting, and hopefully for our readers and listeners. Let's pivot then very quickly to, I guess, a very different kind of story. You know, we write an awful lot about our, M&A and breakaways and things. What we don't talk about an awful lot is advice firms, robo-advice firms in this instance, doing an IPO. I mean, we don't talk about tons of IPOs in the wealth space, full stop. But
yeah,
Andrew,
usually it's the other direction, right? I mean, the last couple of years, it's been all take private deals. The very few publicly traded wealth adjacent, you know, RIA adjacent sort of wealth management firms that were trading on the public markets have gone private. So, yeah, this is a rare move in the other direction, which brings us to the story, Wealthfront.
I was going to say, we should at some point name the firm. I was trying to get there, but we did it.
Yeah.
Really blind iteming this one. But yeah, Wealthfront has filed for an IPO. That's the story.
Yeah, and they've done the real thing this time. So this is sort of the second, probably, you know, a bigger step than they took earlier this year. So we reported, I guess it was maybe like a month ago. Oh, longer than that. I guess in June they filed a confidential draft S-1, which, you know, the headlines there are, you know, the firm's filing for an IPO, but really it's sort of a shell document. It's not, you know, publicly, the information in that filing is not publicly available. It just goes directly to the SEC and sort of signals that an attempt may be coming for an IPO. They've done the real thing this time. So Wealthfront, of course, one of the largest robo advisors in this space, and they have now publicly filed this S-1, disclosing some details of its financial position and really indicating it's planning to go public. And with a public S-1, usually that will precede the road show. So that company is going to go out and you know, bring its deck and its book out to potential investors, and you know, it's going to have all of the banks that might underwrite this IPO sort of figure out a share price. And, you know, an IPO may actually materialize within a matter of weeks, months, but it does appear it's really coming this time. It's happening.
And that's interesting, I think, for any number of reasons. I mean, one is also I hadn't thought about Wealthfront for a while, to be honest with you. I hadn't thought about a lot of robo-advisors. You know, I feel there was a period of time, let's say 10 years ago, give or take, you know, when there's a lot of questions about robo-advisors, and, you know, the technology was getting a bit better. And, you know, obviously everyone worried, as they do with every sort of technological update, that this is going to replace the human advisor. Obviously it hasn't. We've seen face-to-face advice, whether RIAs or, you know, classic sort of, you know, big bank wealth management balloon in that time. But Wealthfront, you know, I hadn't thought about it. But then when we wrote the story, it's got $88 billion. You know, it's a lot more money than it used to have. It has seemed to have grown. I imagine the technology is better than ever. People do things online more than ever. But I suppose my question then for you is looking at that filing, understanding what you now do about its financials. Is this a sort of viable thing? Do we think this will be successful? I mean, this is obviously all slightly speculation, but yeah.
Well, I think it makes sense. The one thing that I think is, you know, we say it's an $88 billion robo-advisor. Only about half of that, a little less than half, is assets under management, discretionary assets in robo-portfolios, robo-advised portfolios. The other half, actually more than half, are in cash management accounts, which is pretty interesting when you think about the business mix for a robo-advisor. I mean, yeah, like even the broker dealers of the world, a huge portion of their business mix comes from cash sweep revenue. But I mean, this is more than half. That's a really large fraction, actually, of their business mix. And obviously, interest rates are dropping. So what does that say about their future? I mean, I don't want to speculate too much, but it's just an interesting dynamic here. I do think, you know, they have interesting messaging in that, you know, all of their kind of self descriptions in the S-1 and in the you know, investor materials, they hold out this is a technology company first, which may indicate sort of a divergence from how Wealthfront wants to manage its business versus a lot of other wealth management firms, even kind of fintech or wealth tech firms like the Investnets of the world. You know, they want to operate with very low overhead, which obviously they achieve by not hiring, you know, lots of flesh and blood advisors. That's one way that they've really deviated from their other largest competitor in the space, which is Betterment, which, you know, those two companies have emerged as probably the preeminent, you know, we'll call them robo-advisors.
Standalone robos. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right.
They started in a similar place, perhaps, yeah.
And they've taken very different paths. So Betterment is, you know, trying to become a more full service wealth management platform. They have human advisors with this kind of hybrid, you know, robo plus human financial planning model. They've got custody, they've got models, they've got all kinds of, you know, all the auxiliary, secondary, tertiary kind of business lines. They're really trying to position as a, you know, the Schwab of the future, which is a term that they've used, CEO Sarah.
Yeah,
I remember your
interview. They sort of, they were very Schwab focused. They sort of saw themselves in that, you know, that prism.
And I get it. You know, they see an opportunity to come in and have that brand recognition and that brand loyalty with a you know, demographic of much younger, much more tech forward investors. And so they're trying to grow that business as the kind of, like, you know, the net worth and the wealth management needs of that demographic changes. You know, and Wealthfront has similar messaging, right? They want to target very young investors, and they want to kind of mature along with those investors. They're just taking a very different track at it. So I don't know. Obviously, they've emerged as a winner in this space, one of very few. They're a very low cost option, you know, and they've got they seem to have some sort of plan, right? So let's see how it works out for them. Obviously, they're not a great proxy for the broader wealth management business, and wealth management firms generally have not done great on the public markets of late. But you know, this is something different. So we'll see how it turns out for them.
Yeah, I thought that was literally going to be my next question. Was, yeah, whether we can really sort of use this as a benchmark for other wealth firms might do, and perhaps the answer is no. But yes, yeah,
not the pure play RIAs. Yeah. I just think the model is too different. Too much of their money is coming from cash management. It's just a little bit too different of a business model. And I think, like, you know, $88 billion, you would never see an $88 billion RIA try to go public. You're not going to see you know, a half a trillion dollar RIA try to go public. I mean, maybe, but I think Peter Malouk still got a ways to go before, you know, really seriously considering that. And I just think there are more advantages for pure play RIAs to
stay in the private markets.
Stay private. Yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Excellent. Well, look, I am conscious that we've pulled Alec in on a day off, and he's probably still... Can you get jet lag from a trip to Georgia? You can't, but he's tired from
If you talk yourself into it enough, then yeah.
Okay, fair play. All right. So look, I think we should probably call it there. I will say, but before we do, actually, I have a segment that we pre-recorded with Ian talking about something that we talk about a lot on this podcast, but I think is really interesting. And that's obviously RIA, M&A. And we had a doozy of a deal this week with Ares buying into the $40 billion shop EP Wealth. So I'm not quite sure how to do this because we haven't done it before, but I'm going to tee up a segment. Here is Ian and I speaking earlier about that deal. Ian, you're back. We couldn't keep you away. I would say not a full debut, but certainly an appearance. We missed you, obviously.
You're going to have to CGI me into the other segments on this episode, like Grand Moff Tarkin in Rogue One.
Yeah, I know that's a Star Wars reference, but I don't know enough to comment further. But yeah, I think what we'll probably do is we'll have this as a segment of the wider episode. But it will sate the appetite of those listeners who tune in for their weekly dose of Wenig.
It'll keep my mom happy.
Among other things, yeah, hopefully. So look, you're back, and it's no coincidence that big deals are back on CityWireRIA.com. That's not the website address. One day I'll learn it, but it doesn't matter. Yeah, big deals are back. And this week you reported that EP Wealth, a $40 billion RIA, has sold a stake to Ares. Now, this is notable, I would say, off the bat for two reasons. One, the size of the firm. There aren't loads of $40 billion RIAs out there. But two, the buyer, Ares. Let's get into it.
I mean, look, you know, Ares was one of the few mega private equity firms, alternative asset managers that didn't have a direct equity stake in an RIA. But I think it's worth noting that Ares has had significant exposure to the independent wealth business. They've been a major lender to a lot of the sponsor-backed firms. And so they've really basically directly financed a lot of the industry consolidation that keeps us all employed.
I was going to say, this is it, isn't it? It's like they're by no means a stranger to this trend. If anything, they're probably one of the most exposed private asset firms. I could say private equity, but in this case, sort of mostly private debt firms. To this trend, to this consolidation, that they're funding an awful lot of these deals.
And they were, I mean, it's worth noting that they were a lender to EP itself too. Like it's worth noting that I think what makes this transaction unique, aside from some of the financial details, which we can get into in a little bit, it's fascinating to me that Ares chose to go from a credit relationship to an equity relationship. And so, you know, Ryan Parker, the chief executive VP, said he kind of described it as a coincidence. But I do think it's fascinating that you have this mega RIA simultaneously trying to refinance and raise about $500 million in debt capital and running this equity stake sale process at the same time. So they're kind of loading the proverbial double-barreled shotgun.
Okay, so let's get into this. Let's take those two sides of the equation one at a time. So let's talk about the equity side of things first. So Ares has bought this stake, a minority stake?
Yes, minority stake.
We don't know the exact amount.
We don't know the exact amount. So now we're going to play a little bit of maybe like Clue. Clue's probably a good analogy here. So from some of the materials that we were able to attain while reporting the debt financing, it's worth noting that the primary selling shareholder in this transaction, Berkshire Partners, they were EP's largest individual shareholder with, I believe, it was about a 39% stake. But at the same time, EP is controlled by its management and its founders. They have a voting majority. So people from all different kind of walks of the company
have some sort of stake in this.
And a lot of us, and Ryan Parker told me, that some employees that were retiring got full liquidity through this transaction and some got partial liquidity. and Berkshire is still retaining a stake. So we don't know the exact proportion of who sold shares in this deal. We also do know that Wealth Partners Capital Group, the one of the original minority backers of EP, has fully exited its 4% stake
in the company. Okay, so that's really interesting. So prior to Ares buying in on the equity side of things, but Berkshire had a stake.
Yes.
Wealth Partners Capital had a stake, and EP's employees, management, etc., yes, had positions. And at the end of it, it's now Berkshire, Ares, and again EP management and employees.
Yes, that's exactly what's right. Okay. With management retaining control.
Management still has control. Ares has a minority. Yes. Berkshire sold some of what it had.
But not full exit.
But not fully. And the acronym that I'm going to mess up again,
WPCG,
is now completely out of it. Okay. So that's the equity side of things. And yeah, to your point, so some of those employee shareholders have left the firm, et cetera, got liquidity. Others maybe sold a bit, kept a bit, et cetera. So this is sort of, again, this is sort of the next round, I suppose, of equity funding for the firm. And then let's talk about the debt side, because it is interesting and it is a slightly odd coincidence, I think it's fair to say, that at the same time that it raised money via equity, the firm also raised money via debt. And part of that was refinancing a loan that it already had with Ares.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the debt financing for a minute.
Yeah. So basically, EP sought to raise $500 million through a $400 million new first lien term loan and a $100 million revolving credit facility, which would be undrawn at close of this debt capital raise. And so $325 million of that would go towards refinancing their existing credit facility from Ares. $20 million would go towards funding acquisitions that are already under LOI. You'd have about $5 million to pay fees and expenses associated with one of these broad loan syndications, and then the remaining $150 million or so, that's going right into the firm's balance sheet in the form of cash, which they could deploy for more acquisitions or investment in technology or advisor hires. So it gives them a lot of, and I'm going to sound like a CEO myself, gives them a lot of dry powder to play with.
Okay. I thought you were going to use the word optionality there, but yeah, dry powder is better, less jargony. I would say less CEO-y, but you know. Excellent. Okay. And then the fact that Ares is involved on both sides of the equation, that is a coincidence. There isn't any sort of quid pro quo to the best of our knowledge or...
No direct knowledge of anything like that. I do hope to one day maybe talk to someone from Ares. We can kind of talk about, all right, what made you decide to make the leap now?
Yeah, because that is interesting.
To the equity investment.
Yeah, so it's because as we've discussed, and I think we'll, you know, we want to keep some dry powder here. We think there might be some pieces coming out on this in the near future. But yeah, they've lent to a lot of RIA consolidators, for want of a better phrase. They funded a lot of that merger and acquisitions. But they haven't been on the equity side of things before. Do we have a sense of why now? From, I know maybe you haven't spoken to them, but you've spoken to EP about it.
Not 100%, yeah. I mean, I do think that, you know, one thing that Ryan Parker said was that the reason they chose Ares was the consistency of their message and kind of long-term thinking and plan, which played both on the credit side and in their equity investing thesis. So that was part of why EP chose Ares. I do think it's worth kind of exploring, and hopefully we can do some reporting on this. You know, if you're Ares and you're both a lender to and investor in RIAs, does that create a conflict of interest? We talked about this with Blackstone too, with Blackstone having an equity investment in RIAs while also having that kind of product distribution deal with UBS.
Yeah, or Maryland. Yeah, others and things. Yeah, really interesting. I mean, I suppose Blackstone hasn't made that investment yet, to the best of our knowledge.
No, that has not happened yet, to our knowledge.
And I guess with Ares, the argument would be, well, you have a stake in this firm that you obviously want to see grow and perhaps grow by making deals. Meanwhile, your various of your credit funds are effectively also funding the growth and M&A of firms that will be competing with the firm that you have a stake in. So yeah, I wonder. I suppose they would say different teams,
yes,
different funds. It's a different set of investments for different people within the company, and
yeah,
thus everything would be okay. Excellent. Anything else that we should sort of be across in terms of this deal and where it leaves things, what we expect EP to do next? I think you probably touched on that with some of what they might use the money for. Or was there anything else we learned in reporting this?
Well, I think what I would say is that this is going to make me feel old. You know, we first broke the Berkshire Partners investment in EP about 5 years ago. That was in 2020. And I think you're going to see a lot of these 2020 to 2021 vintages of private equity investments. You're going to see a lot of big, well-known firms hit the market next year. Okay. And this might be the first of many.
Something to keep an eye on. I suppose very quickly, because I'm conscious this is just a segment and not the whole podcast. Anything we learned about EP in reporting this, you know, I believe we got a bit of a look at their financials in reporting sort of some of the debt raise. And that's something that, as we flagged before in this podcast, we don't always get to have a really good look inside an RIA's financials and know, you know, what the margins are or what sort of revenues look like.
Yeah, this is like striking gold. I mean, it's worth noting. So these are all trailing 12 months relative to the end of the second quarter of 2025. $97 million of pro forma adjusted EBITDA on that trailing 12 months on $304 million in revenue. And that translates to about a 32% profit margin, which is, you know, that's strong for any business. And that from sources have told me like, that's a reasonable profit margin for a strong performing RIA.
Excellent. Yeah, really interesting numbers. Really great reporting. Well, look, Ian, it's been great to have you back. It hasn't been the same without you. And hopefully for next week's episode, you'll be back up to full strength, and we'll have you in for the full 25 minutes. Good to see you. Speak soon.
Talk soon.
Excellent. Well, that was me and Ian. For those of you who came for that, I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. Before you go, Alec, before you go and enjoy your day off, commiserations on the Mets. I'm sorry. Last time we spoke, we were one game away, and that game did not go our way.
It's well behind us, you know. We'll be back for more suffering in March. That's, you know, about all I got on that front.
Yeah, no, fair. I didn't mean to leave on a downer. I think as we speak, Ian's biting his fingernails off as the Padres go into that final game against the Cubs. By the time this comes out, the result of that will be known. So if we don't hear from Ian again next week, it's not because of any diary clashes. It's because he's in a deep, deep funk. But on that note, look, Alec, Andrew, thank you both very much for joining me today. Enjoy your day off, Alec. Listener, thank you for tuning in. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.